slightly behind schedule, let's move on to IS-37, Agenda Paper 5.
Okay, I'm Joan. Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Right, so we move to Agenda Paper 5, which provisions, and the board will soon be deciding whether to take on a project to make some amendments to the provision standard IS 37. And the staff, and that's body me, we've been gathering evidence to decide what the board should include in the scope of the project. So what are the problems in IS 37 and whether they could be addressed by amending the standard. And on the basis of the evidence that we've gathered to date, I think we'll probably be recommending to the board that it focuses a project on making targeted improvements in three areas of IS 37. They're summarised, they're listed on page 3 along with the questions for you. One thing I should say before we get into discussing these proposed amendments is that none of them would fundamentally change the approach required by IS 37, and in particular, none of them would make significant changes really to the way in which companies would be accounting for their litigation provisions. So the circumstances in which they would recognise a provision when it's more likely than not that there will be an outflow, the way in which they would measure it at the best estimate, and the disclosures they give. There's no proposal amongst what we've been doing to date to change any of that. So if we start by maybe turning to the first of the three items that we're thinking of looking at and of recommending that the board looks at. That's aligning the liability definition and supporting guidance with the conceptual framework and possibly replacing IFRIC 21, the interpretation on levies. Now, the problem here is all really comes down to obligations that have some sort of conditionality attached to them, and they're conditional on something that the company itself will do, but probably, or in many circumstances, has no practical ability to avoid doing. And when does it? Should it be reporting a liability in these circumstances, or shouldn't it? And this is a problem that affects all sorts of areas of accounting, but it came to a head when the Interpretations Committee was asked to look at levies and issued IFRIC 21 interpretation, which with requirements that I've set out along with the example on page 7. And basically what IFRIC 21 says is that there's no liability until the company takes the action that triggers payment of the levy. So in the example that we've got on page 7, where the company is paying 1% of its revenue if it's on business on the 1st of January in 2000X1, it pays a levy that's 1% of its revenue in the previous year. And applying the existing IFRIC 21, which is an interpretation of IS 37, the levy would all be recognised in one go on the 1st of January. And IFRIC 21 has been criticised quite a lot since it was issued, and largely because of this sort of all of the levy appearing in one go, even if it's sort of been accumulating gradually before then. The board initially thought, well, we'll have a look at IS 37, but then decided that it was a wider project, a wider issue, because it affects all sorts of liabilities. So instead looked at it in the conceptual, in revising its conceptual framework. And included concepts in the conceptual framework that it could now put back into IS 37. And broadly speaking, what the conceptual framework concepts say is that when a company does something that means that it's sort of putting itself on the hook to pay something, so it's receiving benefits or taking in actions that mean it may have to pay out if it does something else, and it has no practical ability to do that something else, it should be recognising a liability. And the effect would be to change the requirements for the levy in the example on page 7, so that the levy would the liability would accumulate as the company earned the revenue on which it would pay the levy if it's still on business on the following 1st of January. So that would be the first change, would be to incorporate this sort of these sort of requirements into IAS 37 and change the requirements for levies, withdrawing IFRIC 21 and putting something else in instead. And it's really whether you have any views on whether the board should be changing IAS 37 in this way, and how it would be likely to change it if it were to incorporate the concept.
Great. So we'll start with James, Peter, and Mitch.
All right. So when IFRIC 21 came in, I was really stunned because my sector, it came at the time when there was a lot of political reaction, imposed levies on the banks. And I thought, I mean, there's a basis for calculation. They've all litigated or put it in their finance bills and budgets, all these countries. Why is this different to an electricity bill that you accrue? You know, if you don't have an electricity bill on 31 March that is exactly from 1st of January to 31 March, you make an estimate. And I was really surprised when this came in. What kind of interpretation was this? You know you're on the hook for this. You accept estimates for a lot of other things. You know, as I say, you might not have an exact meter reading on 31 March for an electricity bill. So, well, why did this come in was really surprising to me. So I really think that what you're proposing is an absolute necessity. That's it.
Okay.
That's quite clear.
I feel strongly about it. I've wasted so much time trying to apportion this damn levy over the quarters.
Yeah. Absolutely agree with that. Sorry, Peter.
I agree with the accrual principle as well. I just think it might be a little bit more complicated than it should be, introducing elements like no practical ability. What if we figure out the practical ability only on November 1st?
Mm-hmm.
You see, it introduces something. I like simple things when they work more than complicated things, and introducing concepts like practical ability seems to make it more complicated than it should be. We make mistakes with our estimates all the time, so let's not make that process contingent upon things that are hard to estimate.
Okay.
You know, sorry, you know, on the same key note, and it raises, of course, from a lawyer's perspective, a huge discussion about moving from realistic ability to practical ability, as in the actual meaning.
Yeah, they are really intended to mean the same thing, in terms of the changing from no realistic alternative to no practical ability was a terminology change. The problem in IAS 37 is that the no realistic alternative that's already in there conflicts with one of the other requirements in IAS 37, or appears to, which says the liability has to exist independently of future events. So it's more the taking out of the statement that it must exist independently of future events, and the no realistic alternative versus no practical ability to avoid is a terminology thing, which the board could consider whether to change the terminology or not. The conceptual framework says no practical ability to avoid. IAS 37 says no realistic alternative. It needn't change the terminology.
Okay, so we're going to go to Deirdre.
That's just a tiny question, really quick. If, just so I understand this, so the entity's operating, and next year some jurisdiction says to operate, you owe us a levy. In one case, it says the levy's a function of last year's revenue, 1%. The other case, it's $1 million. So the $1 million, you would people want that recognized the same way as this accrued 1%?
I would say yes. Yeah. Why would you want to recognize it in a different way?
Doesn't matter.
So how many years, if it's $1 million every year, how many years in advance would you start recognizing it?
Oh, you're talking about P&L or balance sheet. Okay, this is...
I'm just wondering, because I'm not sure that the levy is a function of operating in year 2020. That it's a function of revenues or it's a flat amount. I'm not, like, I just want to make sure I understand what people want with this.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
Oh. So, John, when you say it's the $1 million, pardon me, it's a function of what? It's $1 million. It's a flat fee that's a function of.
It's a flat fee for operating in 2020.
Yes, I would say you would accrue it just like you did 1%. Obviously, missing something because there's more subtleties to it. Right.
Okay, I won't be a laborer, but I just. Okay. Everybody sees that the same.
Actually, I have a comment on that specifically anyway once it's my turn. So.
So let's go to Deirdre, then we'll come to you, Marietta.
I'm not going to add anything, really. I just wanted to reiterate what Peter and James said. It seems natural to accrue it. And just in relation to your query, we have seen levies decline and cease to exist. I suppose in some Central and Eastern European economies, there's been quite large levies applied. And I'm afraid I'm stronger on the income statement than whether or not there was any sort of balance sheet ramifications. But from a user perspective, how we dealt with it was we assumed they had given us explicit guidance and they said it was for the next 3 years. So we would accrue it over the next 3 years and then they told us it was ceasing and we would effectively not charge it anymore. But we were accruing it through the income statement over those 3 explicit years.
Marietta?
I think we're discussing two separate issues in one go here. One is the question whether something is a straight liability or a contingent liability. And on that subject, what I would actually say is that there are all sorts of contingencies, but I think all accounting should be done on the assumption that, you know, the business is a going concern. So, I mean, you know, still being in business next January, to me, that's not sort of like some sort of contingent event that might or might not happen. I think, you know, that should, you know, if there is a liability because you're still in business on January 1, it should be on the balance sheet. And maybe there should be special notes for in case of liquidation, you know, so the administrator knows that it doesn't exist. But the other question, I think this is kind of what you raised, Tom, is, you know, is there actually a liability here or are we literally just talking about costs going up? And I think we've kind of had similar discussions, but more on the revenue side for the rate regulated activities where you're like, okay, you know, there's a decision made that, you know, the price for electricity or whatever goes up. And so the question is, should you actually be putting that on the balance sheet because you're somehow expecting to make more money in the future? And, you know, when you're asking about, like, how many years in any case, well, you know, you don't know when the levy gets scrapped by a new government or changed or whatever, or maybe someone successfully challenges it in court or something. So I would almost say that on this, to me, this is more like just part of the overall cost base going up, and it should be flagged with analysts so they could put the million or, you know, or there's no difference to me between the flat fee and the revenue that's linked to former revenues. Either way, it's sort of like, you know, an ongoing cost that you're going to factor into your future cash flow forecasts. But whatever you end up doing with it, I think it should be consistent with what you're going to do about the rate regulated activities and how that goes into the balance sheet. I have concerns about putting future revenues as an asset onto the balance sheet. So for that reason, I'm also a bit reluctant to put future costs as a liability on the balance sheet. But kind of the flip sides of the same coin, it just needs to be consistent.
Okay. Just before I go to you, Mary, I just want to check, Rosemary or Goro, did you want to add anything to these topics?
Deal with that the new proposal on the levy. I think that this, you know, the pattern of this example is kind of levy is accruing every quarter, so I prefer that the possible new requirements rather than existing requirements, IFRIC 21. Anyway, I'm afraid IFRIC 21 is a bit outdated. It is not consistent with our current conceptual framework. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosemary, did you want to add anything?
No, nothing more to elaborate yet.
Thanks. Mary, sorry.
Mine is just an observation about the nature of the change. Because James and Peter, you looked at this more as if the interpretation and the current requirements had been set because of estimation uncertainty, you know, and difficulties in estimation. And it's not about estimation uncertainty. It really, IS 37 today says, if three things have to happen before you are unconditionally obligated, wait for the last piece of the puzzle. And what this is saying is move it back if there's no practical, you know, what this would say is move it back if there's no practical ability to avoid getting to that third piece of the puzzle. So you can think of it at a very high level as more kind of moving to the type of thinking that's in the pension standard. You may not have vested by providing your 20 years, but you don't wait until you're 20 to recognize it all in one go. And that's why the reason that Tom's question kind of comes up, if it's just a flat fee for everybody who's in operation on January 1st, is that a January 1st expense? Or is it, you know, at some point in the previous year, it becomes obvious you're not going to cease operation by January 1st? So, you know, that's a refinement, but I think we heard a strong message from people here that they think that the idea, at least for levies, of waiting until you get to the last piece of the puzzle is not useful information.
That's very appreciated for the explanation. Sorry, can I speak? On the whole issue of balance sheet recognition, it is interesting that the regulators have taken a view that the need to bolster the deposit guarantee schemes, which is another form of levy, is now deducted from your regulatory capital. So, yes, I think this debate is that the issue that Tom's raised is live about the treating this as a something that definitely as a contingent liability. I see the point, and I really appreciate the explanation of why you did it that way. But I think it's important that you should change this for the P&L, definitely.
Okay, so we've got two more questions to cover. So we're going to go to Bertrand and then back to you, Joanne.
Yes, first one, I don't know about the case where this situation is material, but what comment I would like to do is there any case, it's not the same example, but are there any cases where the charge can be deferred? As an example, if you have an authorization to work in a certain country, for example, for the next year, is there... this is not the same example as here, as I understand. But today, can the company, the issuer, defer the charge or not?
I think there will be some levels in which they may be able to, but it will be very specific. It depends on the facts and circumstances, but there could be some, yes. And they would obviously be different from the one in the example.
Yes.
But they could exist, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting question, though. Is generally around the table, you've heard that people support this mm-hmm. potential move to this approach of accruing. In slide 6, you said some levies, but not all, will be recognised progressively. So is there an example where, if this was in place, some levies would not be recognised on an accrual basis?
There would be examples of some that would be sort of recognised by accruing sort of in advance. There might be others where they would be effectively spread by being treated more sort of like licences and spread up forward. But there would be some, and I think the example of the one that you raised, Tom, in some circumstances could be one that would still just be recognised at a point in time, because until there is only one piece of the jigsaw, as Mary put it, there is only one requirement. You're operating in a market on a particular date And if you're doing that, you get charged a million whatevers. Mm-hmm. There would be no basis for accruing that in advance. There may be a basis for recognizing it as an asset and spreading it forward, but it depends.
Marietta, did you want
to? Yeah, I just had a somewhat similar question, actually. Mm. I mean, how does this currently or in the future apply to something like business rates? So if business rates go up, I mean, in a way, you could look at this as a levy. But of course, I mean, in theory, you could actually somehow reduce your business space and rent out the other half or whatever.
Yes.
So I just again, in terms of like sort of consistency and just from my own understanding of like, you know, what the scope of this would be, what sort of how would it work?
If it was business rates that are just charged by the year as you operate your business.
Well, there are business rates charged just on your physical premises, which
right.
is a huge problem for
right.
like restaurants or whatever. So they have to pay it whether they make any revenues or not.
Yes, but on a periodic basis, and it would depend on the exact terms of whatever tax you're looking at. But in general, if it's just a periodic charge, that's when it will be recognized, because that's when the company is receiving the benefits that mean that it has to pay these rates. It's operating in that year as a particular business. It's paying its business rates for that year.
Yeah. But that's the same as the levy in a way.
No.
Except that they have a little bit more discretion about reducing
it. I think the distinction, and it's in the paper, but just at a very high level, is it isn't just one test of at what point does it become so probable that you're going to incur the cost that you have to accrue it. Because at December 15th, it's pretty clear you're not going to move out of the building by January 1st, but we're not changing the, you know, when you recognize a lease cost, for example. Maybe not a great example, but mm-hmm. we're also that you aren't, you know, that if you haven't given notice, you're not going to fire your staff, and therefore you don't accrue the whole comp. It's not changing the whole philosophy, because it also says in here that and the entity has received the benefit. You know, that's the other bit of the test. So if that makes this a limited scope change rather than a fundamental sea change in philosophy.
Okay, so time is against us. So Philip, and then we'll definitely move on to the next two questions.
Thank you. No, I was just going to say I really like Tom's example, and I think that sort of brings it to head. And what I'm sort of hearing is that if we think it's a fixed amount, we should have a different accounting treatment than if it's a variable amount, and I don't really understand that. Mm-hmm. I don't think whether the amount's variable or fixed.
As not so much of whether it's variable or fixed, whether you're doing something at a point in time in the future or not. Mm-hmm. So that's why I didn't really understand the comparatives with rates or anything else, because those relate to a period of time that has passed where you've occupied the premises, so you have a liability. I think the question you're asking is if it's a fixed amount but payable only if you're doing something at a future date, would you recognize the liability in advance? I guess that was your
question. Essentially, would it matter to what people thought?
Yeah.
And I got that back, so we should move on. Thank you.
But it seems to me that if we don't know what the amount is, we should be estimating. But if we do know what the amount is, we shouldn't recognize it. That was what I heard. But
go back to slide 5 and the first sub-bullet. And that's really something that I just say, go away and think about as the proposals come, you know, if we go ahead with this.
Let's move on then. Joan?
Okay. Moving on, slides 8 and 9. The second possible topic will be clarifying which costs to include in the measure of a provision. Now, this would primarily affect provisions to provide for the costs of providing goods or services. And so that could be, and it would include onerous contracts. So onerous sales contracts are the sorts of things that could be affected by this. And the board has already proposed amendments to IS 37 to clarify which costs to include in assessing whether a contract is onerous. And it's proposing that it wouldn't just be the incremental costs, it would be an allocation of other directly related costs. And if the board were to progress that amendment to IS 37, what it could also do when it takes this wider review of IS 37 is specify that these same costs should be included in measuring the provision. I think it could affect companies that at the moment are measuring provisions to include only incremental costs. I don't know how big an effect that would actually be if they included other directly related costs or not.
Okay. I mean, do you know what the practice is currently in broad terms in terms of kind of does 80% of entities just include the incremental costs? This is new to me. I thought that would just be incremental.
Well, there's I think you have to divide it into two categories, and one is construction contracts. There's an accounting standard for construction contracts that's just about to be withdrawn, and at the moment, for construction contracts, companies include not just the incremental costs, but a share of the other costs of operating, of carrying out contracts. When this standard is withdrawn and the new revenue standard comes in, there will be no onerous contract requirements for those construction contracts, and so they will apply IS 37. So at the moment, they're all doing, including not just the incremental costs, but other ones. On for anything else, and there isn't a huge pool of anything else, practice is quite varied, I think, in terms of, in theory, whether companies are using just incremental costs or they're including more. What difference it makes to the numbers, I'm not so sure, because for very big contracts, most costs are incremental if you've got very big long-term contracts. So I don't know that for some of these contracts, how much difference it would make. So we don't have numbers on that.
Questions or comments?
Another piece of clear feedback. So we'll move on to the third
just
topic.
One point, if I may, just on this. I think, as I say, for me, it's kind of a little bit of new information that it's not just the incremental costs. And just thinking about it, it would seem to me that if you have perhaps the value of this information is, you know, how badly have you gone wrong or how badly have things gone? So in that scenario, would it not just be more helpful just to have the incremental costs in the onerous contract provision and the ongoing cost not in there, which I thought would be the kind of standard process, but I don't know. Last chance for views from anyone? Okay.
The third topic is described on slides 10 and... 11. 11 to 13. And this is about the discount rate used to measure provisions, and it particularly affects, obviously, the very large long-term provisions. So these would include in the extractive industry the environmental rehabilitation provisions, and in the energy industries in particular nuclear, the asset retirement, asset decommissioning obligations. And the question is whether the discount rate should reflect the company's own credit risk. So if it did, the discount rate would be higher, and obviously they'd be discounting the provision to a smaller number. And there is a very distinct diversity in practice here, in particularly in some jurisdictions, and with some companies using excluding own credit risk and other companies including it, and so obviously they're getting to quite different measures. And what the board could do is specify one or other in the in IAS 37. IAS 37 is arguably unclear at the moment. And if it hasn't had any discussions about which one it would specify, if it did specify one or the other. So if you had any views on that, that would be interesting.
start with Mitch. Go on.
No, just to clarify. So the idiosyncratic risk of a company could speak to the estimated obligation of an exogenous liability is essentially what, if you...
That's one way of putting it, yes.
That makes no sense to me because the exogenous, this liability is exogenous and independent of the credit risk of the company. So that would be a great opportunity for a risked up company to reduce the contingent liability on its balance sheet is the way I see it, which is probably the exact opposite of what you want to see, if I understood that correctly.
Quite a lot of people with their cards up, so we're going to go to Deirdre, then James, Terence, and then Marietta.
Just to agree with what Mitch said, it doesn't make sense to us that they would be allowed to use their credit rating to defer or infer a discount rate, because the lower the credit quality of the company, the higher the discount rate and the liability shrinks. So that just doesn't make sense. There was, when we were discussing it internally, whether or not it would be useful to have a conceptual framework around when a discount rate should be applied, because there are obviously instances where we don't discount provisions currently and then instances where we do. And then with regard to the discount rate that would be used, arguably it's not possible for, or maybe it is, but I wouldn't have thought it's possible for the standard to explicitly set a discount rate. But it would be useful from a user's perspective if maybe there was a disclosure and a standardized discount rate assumption and what that would mean for the liability, because again, it would enable better comparability across industries and or in across entities in an industry.
Thanks, Deirdre. James?
I'll pretty well echo that. Just a thought on the choice of discount. I totally agree with Mitch on this. This is ridiculous, especially from the point of view that if someone, a higher quality company, acquired this company in trouble, suddenly you'd get that liability exploding, rising sharply in value. But in terms of if you had to set a discount, it's more a question, would you not use the same discount rate, let's say, that you used maybe setting provisions? I suppose that's only for banks. I was just thinking of the IS9 for credit valuations, but it was just a thought that there are other discount rates that you're using in the balance sheet, and this should be the same. Maybe pension one or whatever.
It wasn't clear for me whether you agree with Deirdre's point about a standard or comparable discount rate.
Well, certainly disclosure, but maybe some firmer guidance, like using the ones you've used in the rest of the balance sheet.
Okay. Terence?
Yeah, I think it's kind of echoing a lot of the other comments. I think, yeah, doing that to the discount rate just moves it away from relating to the liability, and it adds another layer of subjectivity, understates the liability, could create more volatility, and just moves further away from a more useful number. Also, I think when you look at a company on a going concern basis, it's not going to give you much comfort knowing, oh, well, at least they put in their own credit risk into it. So it doesn't make sense to me.
We've got three more. So we've got Marietta, Jeremy, and then Goro. So Marietta.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, I think credit risk really doesn't come into the equation. I mean, the big question really is, you know, what return could they actually be earning on the assets they're putting aside now to cover the liability in a number of years' time? And, I mean, I think that should basically be like, you know, the risk-free rate, or, you know, the rate on bonds, you know, in their country, their reporting currency, whatever. Personally, I think, you know, so long as this zero interest rate environment lasts in much of the Western world, I think, you know, for most companies, I don't see why they should actually discount the liability at all. And in fact, if a company has higher credit risk, they're even in less of a position to kind of speculate with their assets and, you know, maybe invest in assets that could actually get them some sort of a 10% return or whatever. So if anything, you know, the higher the credit risk, the more conservative the company should approach this. And yeah, I think the best thing would be just to put the exact liability onto the balance sheet as it's that they'll have to fulfill. And if they have cash lying somewhere and they're earning, you know, great returns on those assets, I mean, that will actually be showing up in the asset side of the balance sheet. And then you can sort of over time, and you can sort of see there that, you know, they're sort of like their financing is generally improved, or they're in a better position to cover their liability. But I think, you know, fudging with the liability number is not the right way to do it.
Thanks, Marietta. Jeremy?
I'm just echoes with the pension discussion. I think what's really interesting would be, if possible, the schedule of kind of cash flows associated with the kind of central case or the bear case, and also the tax shield on that as well. And so in terms of discount rate, it doesn't matter too much as long as there's some sensitivity given. The other type of sensitivity may be the kind of time delay from now to the start of the provisions, particularly thinking of a decommissioning liability. If that was to shift out 1, 2, or 3 years, what would happen then to the measurement?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Clearly, I prefer that the some kind of standard discount rate, and that this standard discount rate should exclude own credit risks. That the unless an entity should buy back the liabilities, it cannot recognize the capital gains. However, buying back its liabilities means that the entity is technically bankrupt, forcing the creditor that accepted debt forgiveness. And if an entity dares to do so, it will be forced out from the capital markets and need to pay significant penalty to re-enter the markets. Therefore, the gain resulting from the deterioration of their own credit risk may accrue conceptually. It does not appear to be possible to realize the gain in practice. Mm-hmm. If this is the case, I don't think that it is appropriate for the entity to include its own credit risks. And there may be some preparers who might suffer from the increase in the amount of provisions, but this simply reflects the fact that their level of provision is not sufficient just because of the overstatement of the discount rate. Thank you.
Thanks, Nora. We go to Bertrand and then Glenn.
Yes, I don't know about the standardized discount rate. There is, in fact, potentially the mix between discount rate, the couple between discount rate and inflation rate that may have an influence on the valuation of the provision, you know. So this has to be taken maybe into account. Because you may have different assumptions relative to inflation and the commitments to decommission some long-lived assets may depend on the inflation over the period of time.
Glenn.
It depends on, my view on this is it depends on what provision you're talking about, but I go back to the point I made about pensions, which is buyout cost or buyout methodology, which is, so the big one in this field are decommissioning liabilities, where there are standards for this in terms of buyout cost because the companies of all, at least in Europe, have tried to buy out their liabilities with the state, and the state has basically given them estimates for what that buyout cost will be. So there's a very, very interesting study by Grant Thornton, as it happens, done on the German nuclear industry. And the German government stepped in because, of course, interest rates are negative in Germany, so the discount rate would be, you know, would actually increase the liability, the provisions in the German theory. The German government stepped in there. And there's a whole paper which would be very interesting, which looks at the whole theory behind all of this. But long and short of it is that the credit spreads may be relevant, but not in the way that people think, which is that the credit rating may be relevant, but not in the way that people think, which is that when you're investing, when you're discounting liabilities, you should deduct the credit spread from the return. And when you're doing the other way around, you should add it. And when you're doing assets, you should deduct it. So rather like a prime broker, like a prime broker would charge a hedge fund on the margin that they take, they ask you to put the cash. They don't obviously give you the LIBOR rate of interest. They give you Libid less your credit rating on that thing, and they charge you LIBOR plus your credit rating. So the spread between the two is a reflection of your credit rating, but obviously doubled if you're buying and selling. It used to be said, many years ago, I worked on the privatization of the UK electricity industry. And one of the things at the time it used to be said in the state-owned industry by the nuclear engineers is that the industry was so risky that really what you had to do was to raise the discount rate. And the more you raise the discount rate, the more valuable the nuclear projects became because the costs were really so far out. And so this was a kind of game that the very clever nuclear engineers used to play, is to say, oh, no, it's more risky than you think. Add another 5% on. And obviously the discount rates would fall, and suddenly nuclear projects became much more attractive relative to coal. And they would go on playing this game by saying, oh, no, it's much more, you think it's that? No, it's not. It's fabulous risky. But that's because they were adding to the discount rate, the credit rate, as opposed to deducting, because what they should have been doing was saying, okay, here's the government rate of interest, and our credit rating is risky, and so we're going to deduct. And that obviously lowers the discount rate and raises the provisions. And I think the concept of spread is really important here. So the credit rating is relevant because it determines the spread, and it must be careful not to just simply assume that it's the liability rate of interest as opposed to the asset rate of interest that you're, or the other way around, that you're taking into account. It is relevant, and it is used in the financial, as I said, prime brokers charge funds based on their credit rating, but it's not what you think. It's the other way around. You get less on margin, you pay more on borrowings.
Okay. I think it's a first for CMAC in terms of questions 1 and 3. We're almost unanimous in our views. I don't think it's happened very often before, at all before. So.
Thank you very much for that.
And question 2, we didn't help you at all. Come back to us.
Job, thank you.
So break for lunch, and we'll meet again at 1:45.
Thank you, Goro.